British film director Mike Lee does not like journalists. The last journalist who talked with Mike Lee for more than 40 minutes was found chopped up in a plastic bag, his detached arms being munched on by a starving Cocker Spaniel. None of this gets away from the fact that Mike Lee is one of our greatest filmmakers. I decided to talk with him again. Knowing that Mike Lee did not like journalists, ergo Mike Lee did not and would not like me, I decided to pretend to be a journalist. I sometimes asked Mike Lee sincere questions and sometimes subjected him to outright bullshit. Mike Lee's answers were very much in the same vein, sometimes sincere and sometimes bullshit. So I ask you, dear listener, who was bullshitting whom? Was it Mike Lee? Was it me? The result, in any event, is a quite strange conversation. Enjoy! Okay, so I am here once again with Mike Lee, who is most recently the writer and director of Another Year. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Nice to be here again.
Nice to have you here again. I wanted to, first of all, start with just an observation I made. When I came out of this movie, the first thing that came to mind was Kurt Vonnegut's God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, where there's that famous line, "There's one rule in life, God damn it, you've got to be kind." And it occurred to me that not only was this film about kindness, but your last three have really been perhaps more about kindness as a coping mechanism to survive against societal forces than some of your other movies. And I was wondering if thematically kindness has been more on your mind lately, or whether this is just some subconscious result from your organic process.
I think it would have to be the subconscious result from my organic process. There's nothing to do with the process. Process is just a sort of technicality.
Yeah.
No, I hadn't particularly thought of what you've just said, but now you mention it, I think it's true. So there you go.
You've said in other interviews previously that if there is any kind of political element to your films, it's, you know, well, it's largely balderdash, but you have identified yourself sort of as having a kind of, not being a Marxist, but being more of a sort of leftist guy with anarchist tendencies. To my mind, I think the societal forces that we're talking about in Vera Drake, the government, you know, punishing someone for being generous or being kind. In this, you have kindness almost as a result of occupation or vocation. I mean, you know, you have a situation where Jerry first meets up with Mary and, well, we'll have a drink. It's an hour, the same hour that she is likely to go ahead and generate for like a session with one of her clients. And I'm curious if, you know, if there could be an ascribed political meaning to these films, whether there's anything along those lines, or I think I'm probably got lost in my own particular observation.
Yes,
my apologies.
I have to say I'm a little bit confused by what you
said.
I'm
a little confused too. So.
Yes, well, I mean, I would like to think that I'm more confused than you are, but I don't know. I mean, the kindness. I mean, you know, the people in this film who are kind, are kind, although Jerry is a counsellor, and she gives sort of therapy sessions to people, and I don't think she is kind because she's a counsellor. I mean, she's a counsellor because she's naturally a generous and giving, sympathetic person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, what the film, amongst the many other things it's about, and it's about a great deal more than I think we're talking about at the moment, what it does throw up, however, is the moral dilemma when you are kind and generous, as to where you draw the line. When people overstep the mark, people actually what happens in the film involves somebody being who has received great kindness, suddenly, really by ordinary any decent standards, behaving pretty badly actually, and so in some ways kind of rejected by people who really are generous and kind and welcoming. So that's one of the things the film deals with. But it's very hard for me to quite get my head round the kind of formulaic analysis that you're making, though I think it's very legitimate for you to do so. Because the problem for this particular film for me, although it's very often the case, but it's especially so with Another Year, is that it's about a lot of things.
Sure.
It's about a lot. It's about growing old. It's about loneliness. It's about togetherness. It's about warmth. It's about gazing into the the possibility, the warm, rich possibilities of the future as you get older. And for other characters, it's about gazing into that great black void with terror at growing old. It's about lost opportunities, about failed relationships. It's about death, and it's about children. And so, and what I've just said doesn't begin to sum up what it's actually all about.
No, not at all.
You know, not at all. So, it's very hard. It was quite a tough film to make for all those reasons, and it's quite a hard film, I find, to talk about in a sort of simple and graphic way.
Yeah.
And within all that, I'm not too sure that I completely comprehend your own discombobulated analysis.
No problem. Not a problem. I mean, in light of the fact that this movie is more complicated to the norm, maybe we could start off with a simple thing and veer into more complex waters. Why do you think this particular film ended up being more complicated? Was it the cyclical nature? Was it simply the fact that you demanded greater? I mean, it seems to me that there was even greater attention than the norm to. I mean, I looked up, for example, the narcissistic personality disorder in the DSM-4 because Mary, to my mind, pretty much hit that to a T. And to my great shock, every single symptom was almost conveyed in that. And this also leads me to ask if you had consulted any psychiatric tests during the preparation process.
Not at all. It's I haven't done any of that. I think the reason it's more complex is it is about long lives, older people, partly. It's about complex emotional journeys and relationships. It's real, I hope. And I suppose it's denser than perhaps some of my other films are in some way. I mean, I suppose the other thing that is of some interest to people, or perhaps of some importance, is this. My last film, Happy-Go-Lucky, which focused on people, youngish people, people around 30, had this open and generous spirit, which was because it was about successful, emotionally successful people at that age, for the most part. Although, of course, you've got this famous character, the driving instructor, Scott, played by Eddie Marsan, who is completely screwed up in his mid-30s. But apart from anything else, I decided next I wanted to look at, I mean, I'm 67.
Yeah.
I wanted to look at my own generation, really.
Yeah.
And with that comes complexities, because we've been around for a long time. You know, you've been through a lot of stuff by the time you get to...
Could it be perhaps the protracted time for this film? I mean, you're a guy who started off doing Abigail's Party, which is essentially... I mean, didn't start off, but that's essentially a real-time dramatic presentation. And a lot of your previous films have been contained in this smaller time period. Do you think that the expansive one-year situation... I mean, Topsy Turvy took place over... 2 years.
Yeah, Topsy Turvy was outside the discussion, I think, of what we're talking about right now. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, my films have generally, I generally go for a limited short time span. Here, although the film does happen over four seasons, it doesn't log everything that happens for a whole year. Yeah. I mean, we dip in and out. We go within each season. There's a very specific thing that happens, and you miss out a massive amount of information about what went on in other aspects of their lives between. I mean, the evolution of how I arrived at the four seasons arose partly because I wanted to find a way of dramatizing Tom and Jerry's relationship to the earth. They grow stuff. They have an allotment, as we call it in England. He's a geologist. And they're nurturing people. And I wanted to do something in some way to dramatize the environment. How do you dramatize environmental green things? I don't know how you do it. The second
thing... a slideshow presentation like what? Al Gore. Al Gore and his slideshows, you know?
Well, he hasn't dramatized it. He's made a documentary. That's not the same thing. The second thing was that I shared with the cinematographer, Dick Pope, a sense of the spirit of the film, and he shot tests, because there were four different ways it could look. And the third thing is, and I had to decide which one of those four ways to go, the third thing was that I realised that Mary, who visits the main Tom and Jerry, the main characters, I wanted their relationship with her to be central to the story. But she's somebody who only comes round occasionally. So if you had the whole thing lasted 4 weeks, she only come round once and there wouldn't be a story, basically. Yeah. So I realised it needed to be a longer time span. So suddenly, when I looked at these tests that had been shot by the cinematographer, I suddenly realised that four seasons was the answer.
Yeah.
And that then liberated the whole of the rest of the story and informed everything we did.
Yeah.
So, you know, you actually have something that's very appropriate to happen in the spring and in the winter and so on and so forth.
You mentioned leaving out certain aspects of the story. And
no, I didn't. I don't miss out certain aspects of the story. What I said was, and it's quite an important distinction, I said we miss out lots of aspects of their lives. That's not the same. The story is what we see.
That's true. But with that in mind, I think specifically of the tremendous transformation that Mary has from autumn to winter. We know that something has happened, something that has involved, I'm going to try to not spoil the movie, but something that has involved an encroachment upon Tom and Jerry's turf.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily need to know what has happened, but the point
is... Well, we do know what's happened.
Yeah.
We do. I mean, when you watch the film, you're very clear what's happened because you saw it happen.
Yeah. But we're not specific. The actual incident that did happen is it's like off screen.
No, it's not. It's on screen. It happens before our very eyes.
Oh, okay. That then we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to also ask about Tom and Jerry because...
Sorry, let's just pick you up on that, because if it was something where we didn't know what it was, I don't think the film would make any sense. You have to know what it is that's the issue. But you were there. You saw what happened when she came in and, you know, she behaved badly.
Yeah, okay. Then that's what we're talking about here. Because I had actually thought, in
something,
addition to that,
something else had happened.
No,
you can't. That would be bad storytelling, because how can I... That would be irresponsible. I've got...
Okay.
I have a responsibility as a storyteller to keep the audience in the loop, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Otherwise,
okay,
it goes into the area of some strange, abstracted nonsense, you know.
Okay. I did want to ask about Tom and Jerry and how they are essentially a seemingly stable, self-contained couple. And we, back to this issue of not always getting into their lives, Tom and Jerry essentially approximate that. I mean, there's the exchange between Mary and Jerry where, you know, Mary is pleading to her, oh, well, if you need somebody to listen, and really it's for her, but actually it also reveals that, well, who is the person that Jerry, the counselor, turns to? Presumably it would be Tom, but at the same time, it does beg the question of why Tom and Jerry are constantly there for other people, but we don't know really what... We're not allowed any input into how they kind of let off steam. Essentially, I guess it would be with each other, or it'd be with that moment where Mary's in the other room and they're doing that funny little routine with the oh my God, she's here, and doing the physical stuff.
Well, it's a difficult question because it presupposes that there is a way they let off steam.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I presume they... I think I would go to say that they certainly let off steam in bed.
Yes.
I mean, they obviously are... Though they are knocking on a few years, they plainly still have a tactile relationship.
Yeah.
But I don't think we should presuppose that, which in a way we may be, you may be doing, that it has to be the case that all married couples have bad patches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even within what you see of them, you see them sort of slightly kind of, you know... sort of on the edge of disagreement about things, but they know how... The important thing is they know how to deal with themselves.
Yeah.
They know how to deal with each other. They understand, and they are not hiding behind anything.
Yeah. But when Jerry says to Mary, it's going to be all right, and then the next breath says, you've got to take responsibility for your own actions,
yeah,
I'm wondering if that inconsistency when... If she knew what she was getting into, because she's a counselor, because she's seen this type of person, because we have at the very beginning an exemplar of how Mary may end up through the cycle, I'm wondering if that's entirely fair to Mary.
Why is it unfair?
to lead her along and to not say from the get-go, you've got to take responsibility for your own actions, and instead...
She says it when she says it. You know, the fact of the complexity is that, you know, she is a counsellor, but on the other hand, this book is a friend, and they're in a private domestic situation.
Yeah.
The fact is she says it, and that's the important thing.
Are your films, would you say, Rorschach tests? And the reason I ask is because two reviews I read at Cannes basically said, oh, well, you know, this movie, these are people who I wouldn't want to meet at a cocktail party. And that leads me to think to myself, well, actually, if that's the case, then Mike Leigh did his job because he presented vivid characters.
Look, yeah. Here's the thing about this. I'm concerned to make films that talk to people who, first of all, I don't want to talk as, like anybody, I only want to talk to anybody who wants to listen, or yeah. wants to know, wants to share, or have a conversation with me, as it were. I can't deal with or account for the kind of sort of media-obsessed, decadent position that can't decode the film for what it actually is, which is to say an open, honest look at real people, how real people are, with their needs and with all their vulnerabilities, warts and all. If you can't embrace that, then go away, basically.
Yeah.
And you're quoting people at Cannes, journalists, no yeah. doubt, who say, you know, I these are people I wouldn't want to meet at a cocktail party. Well, you know, you're not going to meet these people at a cocktail party. You know, clear off to your own, to the cocktail party, and don't worry about this sort of film, because you're not interested, basically. And if yeah. you're not interested, I can't do anything about it. Real people out there, which is to say, not journalists, but people are going to go to the movies, are going to enjoy, be stimulated by, be moved by, be upset, be amused, whatever it is, by this film. And they're not preoccupied with all kinds of sort of, you know, decadent media nonsense, really.
Yeah, and certainly I'm in agreement with you on that. But I'm wondering, though, if it's getting harder to make these kinds of movies, particularly with the austerity stuff that you have going on in Europe, and whether this idea of depicting real life on film is becoming a bigger problem for you, which is why you're doing another play, I know. And so.
No, I'm doing another play because there are reasons. I'm not doing another play because I can't make a film. It's just the next film I want to make will take longer to plan. So,
yeah.
You know. The truth of the matter is, this film has the lowest budget I've had for a long time.
Yeah.
Because of the recession. I don't know. I can't talk about whether it's easier or harder because I just get on and do what I do, basically.
Yeah.
And I never discuss the subject matter or even the style or anything of my films with anybody. We just get the money and we make the films. You know?
Yeah.
So I just get on with it, really.
Well, considering the actors, I know the production notes were very clear to point out how many times each individual cast member and crew member collaborated with you, which I thought was actually quite funny. But I did notice that of all the main cast, at least, only three people had worked for you for the first time. And I'm wondering if that's because of this budgetary issue. Is it harder for you to find actors you can devote their time to?
No. It's okay. Not. It's absolutely not. It's not harder. We are blessed with huge numbers of actors who have got all the time in the world.
Yeah.
No, it's not that. I just chose to cast the people in this film that I did. There's no significance in it whatever, really.
Huh. I also wanted to ask about the triangular sandwiches really quick.
Say it again?
The triangular plastic sandwiches. There's one that appears with Joe in his office and he's clutching it, and then we also see it later at the funeral. Yeah. This seemed to be a very specific choice on your part. Is it reflecting, I guess, the class that these respective characters are
no,
in?
No, well, I mean, it may do that, yeah. But that's not... I've never thought of it in those terms.
Okay.
That is what they would get.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what... If you want to get, you know, if you want to take... They take sandwiches
yeah.
100 miles to this funeral.
Yeah.
And you can buy them at a well-known... department store ready packed in these hard plastic containers, and that's what they got. And the other one is the same. But there's no, I mean, I don't think in terms of, I am making a statement about working class life.
I didn't mean that at all. I meant it as a reflective of their particular station. But
well, what, you know, of course, what you get in my films, as you get in lots of films, but my films, I'm particularly concerned with it, is the accuracy of the details and minutiae of how people live.
Yeah.
And that's what those sandwiches are.
Sure.
Nothing more or less.
One last question.
They're not also, there's no Pythagorean meaning in it.
Got it. Or even an encased shroud of plastic consumerism.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One last question. I was always wanting to ask you if you have ever had to compromise in any way over the course of your career, and whether you have ever had to compromise recently, particularly with, you know, you were mentioning plummeting budgets. I mean, obviously, you have to work with other people. I mean, have you never, you've had to work out some halfway point.
Yes.
What reflects a compromise?
What's never happened is people dictating compromises.
Yeah.
I mean, there are always compromises because you've got to work out what you can do and what you can't do, usually because of money and time. But they're creative compromises that we do voluntarily because it's part of the discipline of making a piece of work, you know. One of the most famous compromises that we did, which was a compromise in many ways, although it became a kind of bonus, which was that when we embarked on making Topsy Turvy, the budget was bigger than it wound up being because there was the Southeast Asia crisis, and the Korean backers pulled out after we'd started preparing the film, and you couldn't replace that £1.75 million that went. So what we actually had to do was to cut all the exteriors. There are one or two tiny exteriors which we constructed, but the actual, you know, Gilbert walking down the Strand, Gilbert on his famous motor yacht, Sullivan at the races, all those things went. In the event, I think the film didn't suffer from that because it is very much an interior film. But really, in terms of the kind of compromise where you actually do what you don't really believe in, and you finally make up, you wind up doing something that you feel is devalued, and you don't want people to see, and you wish you'd never been born. That's never happened at all. Every one of my films, I've totally is in that sense totally uncompromised. Nobody's ever messed one of my films up. They've tried on a couple of occasions, but they've never succeeded.
What's the closest you've come to acquiescing?
To acquiescing?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't.
Okay. Well, on that fun note, Mike, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
You too. Thank you very much indeed.
Sure.
Scattered shadows on a wall, you watch the long light fall. Some impressions stay and some will fade. Tattered shoes outside your door, and clothes all on the floor. Your life feels like the